Welcome to the podcast of the City Club of Eugene, Oregon. The City Club builds community vision through open inquiry and is dedicated to enabling an informed public on a wide range of topics. Coming up in today's program.
What has caused this new normal of hazardous conditions, including spades of poor air quality all the way to Central Park in New York? Is it the overzealous forest fire suppression policies? Cessation of historic prescribed burns by Native Americans? People moving into the wildland-urban interface? Modern forest management practices? Climate change? Or all of the above?
We appreciate the sponsors who make our civic work possible, including Kaiser Permanente, kp.org, Lane Community College, lanecc.edu, Peace Health, peacehealth.org, the University of Oregon, uoregon.edu, and generous support from Lane County and the City of Eugene. And here's today's program.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the City Club of Eugene's October 22nd, 2021 program. Today's program is Responding to Fires in the Western Cascades. My name's Kitty Piercy, and I'm the City Club President. Support for the City Club is provided by our members and sponsors. You can become a member of the City Club at our website, cityclubofeugene.org. In today's program, we welcome speakers Amanda Astor, Associated Oregon Loggers Forest Policy Manager, and John Bailey, PhD, Oregon State University Forestry Ecosystem Department. Biographical information on our speakers is available on our website, cityclubofeugene.org. I would like to thank John Belcher for coordinating today's program. So the program is Responding to Fires in the Western Cascades. 2020 was yet another incredible year for wildfires in Western Oregon, with over 1 million acres burned, at least 11 deaths, and the loss of most of the towns of Detroit, Blue River, and Vida. Fires of 2021 are still burning over hundreds of thousands of acres. What has caused this new normal of hazardous conditions, including spates of poor air quality all the way to Central Park in New York? Is it the overzealous forest fire suppression policies? Cessation of historic prescribed burns by Native Americans? People moving into the wildland-urban interface? Modern forest management practices? Climate change? Or all of the above? Most importantly, what can you and I do to make our forests more resilient? In this program, we will hear the perspectives of John Bailey, OSU professor, an expert on fuels manipulations and wildlife fire science, and Amanda Astor, Forest Policy Manager for Associated Oregon Loggers. Join us to learn more about this hot topic in just a few minutes here.
Thank you, Kitty, for introducing both our subject and our speakers. We're very pleased to have both Dr. John Bailey and Ms. Amanda Astor here today, and I will turn it over to John to start the program. Go ahead, sir.
Thank you very much. So I'm a professor at Oregon State University and really been looking at these fire issues for a long time, since the time I was actually an undergraduate student at Virginia Tech and a firefighter. And over the span of that career, we've really gained a lot of information about particularly fire history and fire ecology. And so that's where I'm going to start today, is just kind of reviewing that background really briefly, because we want to get to the kind of the current situation we're in. But it's an important context to remember. And to do that, I'm going to show a few pictures and describe them for the listening audience. First being a Douglas fir dominated forest, as is, you know, most of the Western Oregon forest, but in this case, a picture that has some ponderosa pine in it, so indicating it's a warmer, drier site. And so we'll call it a dry pine site that historically, prehistorically, was a pine dominated instead of Douglas fir dominated. And these, we go into these kinds of areas and following the line of research, looking at fire history and fire ecology. And we find dead wood that's in there, and we can cut into that dead wood and identify the years and amount of fire that was in this in these forests going back many hundreds of years, centuries. So it's a often we can go even before Euro-American settlement. And so when we do that, we can piece together based on multiple fire scars across a hillside in a stand like this and identify all of the fires occurring, in this case, multiple instances of fires starting in 1717, the year 1717, going all the way up to the Euro-American settlement of the area, 1895. And those that can see it are, you know, see a list of a good 20 fires or so that happened at sporadic intervals across those centuries and those decades. And mathematically, what it converts to is on average one fire every decade, a little bit less, 8.9-year mean fire return interval into these kinds of stands. The point being, there was a lot of fire burning in these areas. When you walk through the forest and see ponderosa pine in the mix of conifers, it's an indicator there was a lot of fire in there. Even better indicator is when you walk through stands that have oak, Oregon white oak, where the oak, some oak is still alive, or in a lot of cases, they're Douglas fir dominated forests that have dead oak in them standing or down on the ground. And this is a picture of dead oak logs laying on the ground in addition to some standing. And when we piece together that fire history, we see a very similar pattern with fires going back into the early 1700s up through the 1800s with a mean fire return interval of about 5 years. And that we know reflects a lot of indigenous burning practices as well in these landscapes. But with Euro-American settlement, we turned off the faucet with that much fire in the landscape. The Douglas fir prospered from that, and they've become Douglas fir dominated forests now, and to the detriment of Oregon white oak or ponderosa pine. The real Douglas fir sites, dry Douglas fir sites, we also can construct that. It's not as much fire in there, ranging from the early 1700s to the late 1800s. But a good dozen fires or so in that period. If you do the math, that's a mean fire return interval of every 15 years. So think about that. Every 15 years, so during a 45-year career in an area, on average would be three fires that burn through that area. And even areas with western hemlock in it that at one time in my career I thought was an indicator of no fire, when we really go in and look for evidence of fire, we see multiple fires, even where we have western hemlock, but maybe only one or two fires per century in those areas. So I'm going to stop sharing and looking at pictures and just emphasize that point that there was a lot of fire in the landscape. We largely turned that spigot off and changed our land management mindset to one of excluding fire from the landscape, actively suppressing fire, which then excludes it from other parts of the landscape. And that was part of our mission, both on private lands and on public lands. And we did that with the idea that we were saving, protecting, preserving the forest. But the key is that, you know, fire is a creative and regenerative force in addition to being a destructive force. And so this history and prehistory of fire that we had created and maintained a forest condition that was out there. We interrupted that. We've now accumulated fuels and built forested structures that aren't nearly as resistant and resilient to fire. And so when we're getting fire out there now, it's not a low intensity or even a mixed intensity kind of fire that leaves surviving individuals behind and moving forward into the future. But it can also often be these stand replacing events. So that dynamic of the fire has changed. And so that leads us to our current condition, and that the whole question about our fire season getting worse and what's going on out there. And I typically address that as, you know, three things that are coming together to drive this. First off, climate is becoming warmer, that is, and our fire seasons are getting longer. We have to be ready earlier in the year and deploying our resources. The fuels are drier early. We're reaching real depths of dry fuels and hot conditions that are ideal for high severity fire. They're persisting further into the year, and so that creates a situation for us. And it's not that we don't have a lot of data yet that storms are getting worse or winds are getting higher or that kind of stuff, but just the fire season being longer and the period of time where things are hotter and drier, that just changes the probabilities, and those probabilities catch up with us to create things like last year's Labor Day fires, this year's Bootleg fire. So part of the signal is definitely the fire season and climate change. A big part of the signal is just that fuel accumulation. We've interrupted the flow of fire and that natural disturbance agent in the forest. And our basic land management practices over time have driven the accumulation of fuel on the landscape, particularly on federal lands, where here in the state of Oregon, that's half more federal ownership. About 90% of each year's growth, the trees are growing every month, every week, every year. Fuels are accumulating, and on federal lands, about 90% of that just accumulates, both as living and dead material. And about a third of it is dead. So that all is fuel. Yes, it's wood, it's habitat, it's stream protection, it's scenery, it's recreational opportunities, but it's also fuel. And so that fuel accumulation has matched up with a longer fire season. And then the third leg is we just have more humans out there, both to ignite these and our infrastructure to ignite the fires, but also to be impacted by the fires. So those are the three forces that have come together that gives us this perception that things are now worse. Specifically for the Holiday Farm fire, Beechey Creek, and all that kind of stuff, I think at this point I'll hand it off to Amanda to kind of talk about what those fires did and how lands were impacted by
it. Yeah, thanks, John. I completely agree. Climate change and local weather patterns have absolutely contributed to longer fire seasons, extreme drought conditions, dry vegetation, low fuel moistures, hot weather, low relative humidity, on and on and on, right? And so when it comes to the Holiday Farm fire, Archie Creek, Lion's Head, the Labor Day fires of 2020, we had all of that happening, but we also had a historic easterly wind event. These are known events that have happened, but this one was in particularly extreme. So the winds knocked down trees, branches, and unfortunately power lines. The blazes quickly spread across our landscapes, into our communities, and that caused hazardous fuels to ignite and firefighting conditions to get extreme quickly. We were really in triage mode with Associated Oregon Loggers. Our contractors are firefighters, and so are many foresters out there responding quickly. But everybody was in triage mode. Our firefighting staff was stretched thin across the United States, across the West especially. And with fires that were going at extreme speeds due to that wind event, direct attack couldn't be utilized. So resources were needed to build contingency lines for backburning, to hold the fire before it could enter additional communities, poor visibility. But thankfully, we were able to get things under control, mostly because the winds changed. So now where are we at? Well, there's some interesting research that goes to show that we really are not going to be having many of these easterly wind events moving forward. That's what modeling shows, at least. Some research out of the University of Washington's Department of Atmospheric Science shows that as wind warms and as the climate warms, the the easterly wind events might become less frequent. This is because the wind events are caused by cold high pressure systems that come down from Canada and warm low pressure systems that come up from California. Where those mix, that is where we got these big wind events. With the temperatures rising, those cold high pressure systems are going to be less likely to occur. That I'm not a meteorologist. I am not a climate scientist. This is just what I have been told and the research that I have seen and reviewed. So that is positive. However, I do want to put a caveat in there. With warming does come additional drying, additional evaporation, and what we call evapotranspiration, declining snowpacks. And so it's really unclear what the future has in store for us. It may not be likely that we have these easterly wind events as often that cause events like we had during the Labor Day fires of 2020, but it's unclear. So the best thing that we can do is to try to prepare for them, you know, to do all that we can to create forest resiliency across our landscape. And so that's really, you know, what we're excited to talk to you about. So with that, I'm going to pass it back over to John.
So what is going to be the role of forestry and active forest management? As we look at wildfire behavior and this emerging problem, we don't have any control, you know, over the weather. We have to be aware of what's going on and track it. And another thing that really regulates wildfire behavior is topography, you know, particularly steep slopes. But that's also kind of a given for our various forest owners to deal with. Now, the only part of the equation that we can manipulate, and particularly with forest management, is the fuel side of the triangle. And so that's going to be both at the time when we're doing harvesting of various types and how we prepare a site, how we manage stand density over time, and how stands develop. So that's the implementing thinning or other stand management kinds of operations, and also prescribe fire, using fire itself as the tool it once was for keeping the level of fuels down on the landscape. Prescribed fire is particularly good at eliminating fine surface fuels that are the vector, the carrier for much of the wildfire behavior and surface fire behavior. Even when it's a spectacular crown fire under high wind events, it's still a very important component, is all of the material that is down on the surface that is burning in the process. So that's the one side of this that we're going to be able to manage. And one point to make now is that, you know, the idea of, you know, not doing something in the forest, more of this reserve mindset or preservation mindset, is part of what's gotten us into this issue. The idea of not manipulating the vegetation, including not letting fire proceed into these forests, you know, that can work on small spatial and temporal scales, that we can preserve. We can set aside an area and say, okay, we're not going to do anything here. But in a dynamic world, that only works on the shortest temporal scales and the smallest spatial scales, because we live in a dynamic world. And, you know, we've seen plenty of events like the ones we've already talked about that burned well through lines that we drew on maps in order to set aside areas. So there is no solution where we can just say, we just won't have wildfire in this area. That's not going to be a choice. Our choice is going to be to actively manage the landscape. Now, there are multiple landowners that make up our landscapes. I've already talked about federal landowners and how we've backed off on the proactive management on those landscapes. Small woodland owners have a role to play in this as well, in terms of viewing their forests as the wonderful thing it is and all the things that it represents, but also remembering that it's fuels and managing those surface fuels, as well as the ladder fuels that connect the surface fire behavior to the crowns, and even managing the amount of aerial fuel up there. So it comes back to that message building in resilience in our forest and in keeping the total amount of fuel and the relationship of those fuels to each other down. And that's part of even the national cohesive strategy where we've looked at having resilient landscapes as well as treating the urban interface where the wildlands come into our communities and how we protect structures and having fire safe communities in a resilient landscape. And then overall making for the safest and most effective responses when we do want to suppress. I'll let Amanda talk about what private landowners are thinking about and industrial landowners.
Yeah, thanks, John. Private landowners and industrial landowners definitely are doing their part to maintain not just their forests as healthy forests, but maintain that access into the forest. I think one of the things that we see when these big fires take off is that private lands are often, and the roads that get to private lands or go through federal lands to get to private lands are often utilized as fire breaks. Those plantations can be used as safety zones. You have more stability and uniformity, and that's, because it's a plantation, it can be more easy to understand how a fire may move through those landscapes. Because you have that uniformity. And I think that, the other thing that's important to note is that we really are all in this together. As John said, this is not a one landowner problem. It really is everybody coming together, uniting in the fight to address these issues. And I really want to make clear that In 2019, the Governor's Council on Wildfire Response came out with recommendations to what we need to do in the state to achieve our forest resiliency goals and to achieve our response goals, and not to mention our adaptive community goals, so to fire as well. So those are three things that we all need to be doing. And the people that were on the Governor's Council and on the subcommittees were people from all different land ownerships. You had people from academia, people from federal land management, industrial land management, again, coming together to say, okay, how are we going to deal with this? And what is so great is that out of that bill and out of that council and these recommendations, this past legislative session in this long legislative session in 2021, we actually developed bipartisanly a bill called Senate Bill 762. Now, this is a wildfire omnibus bill. It funds a lot of things, but we have to remember that more than anything, this is to show proof of concept and develop a framework. It's really important to note that, yes, there's a lot of things that are funded. It came with a large price tag, $220 million. But again, that's a little bit of money for a lot of different things. And we're gonna need a lot more to be able to achieve our goals. The Governor's Council on Wildfire Response found that 5.6 million acres need to be treated in the state over the next 20 years. And as we've mentioned before, about 65% of that, if not more, is actually on federal lands. And so again, it's an all hands on deck. Thankfully, a handful of years ago, the state signed a shared stewardship agreement with the U.S. Forest Service and basically said, we are going to be good neighbors. We are going to be good stewards of the land. We're going to share in that responsibility. And so one of the things that the bill, Senate Bill 762, did is that it funded at the tune of about $20 million a program for forest resiliency to develop forest resilient landscapes. And it also requires the Oregon Department of Forestry to develop a 20-year strategic plan to achieve that 5.6 million acres that is in need, desperate need of treatment to address that high fuel loading that is just constantly being added to, as Mr. Bailey mentioned. 90% of growth every year on federal lands is just getting added to and added to and accumulating every year in dead trees and in new growth. And so we need to address that, right? And one of the ways that we can do that is through harvesting, is through mechanical treatments of the lands in combination with, when needed, prescribed fire. But the great thing is that whenever we manipulate fuels, whether that's through non-commercial treatments, going into roads, creating good fuel breaks, or we're doing prescribed fire, piling and burning, or doing broadcast burning, or we're treating the landscape in any way, because fuel is not only in the fire triangle, but the fire behavior triangle, we will always achieve fire behavior changes when we manipulate those fuels. And as Mr. Bailey likes to say, it's physics, but it's also chemistry. It's both of them together. And so I really just want to make mention of that. And there's a ton of research out there. OSU has done some recent research to show that thinning alone can result in observable changes in fire behavior. When combined with prescribed fire, that's when we really hit the money. But it's tough sometimes with smoke management rules and not having good burn windows and adequate conditions to safely burn. At the very least, we can thin out our forests. We can do patch cuts and clear cuts in some locations, and really make a difference to the fuel load across the landscape. So, like I said, I think it's really important that we all came together, developed this these recommendations a few years ago, and we're actually making actionable changes in the state. And it's not just for resilient landscapes. It's also transmission system plans, statewide mapping of wildfire risk, new regulations for defensible space, land use, building codes. All sorts of things are being developed right now and worked on. Lots of folks that are from OSU and are coworkers of Mr. Bailey, and I'm engaged, and lots of other people are engaged.
If you enjoyed this presentation by the City Club of Eugene, please visit our website at cityclubofeugene.org or our YouTube channel and our social media pages.